Feminist Women.
Mulheres feministas.
Zanone feminist.
Vanyu Vachikonzero Chevakadze.
Nessa.
Mulheres feministas.
Yam femini. Femactivi.
Nari Mukti.
Matapang na babae. Kechimae. Ka ishk.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Women's Magazine. Today is Monday, September 23rd, 2019. I'm Sharon Sabota, and I'm your host and producer for this afternoon. Coming up on today's show, what's happening behind the scenes in Hollywood and showing up on the show as we stream at home.
It's mostly guys.
But you're there.
But I'm there, and I'm a loudmouth. So, it's me and another female.
Rebecca Sonnenschein, executive producer of The Boys, The Crossing, Outcast, and Vampire Diaries, tells us how women's presence in writing rooms is impacting the stories we consume. What don't we know about American military bases in other parts of the world?
Only about 4% of rapes are reported to police, and service members have admitted that knowing that fact helped lead them to commit sexual assault.
Akemi Johnson shares what she found is at stake for women on and around the U.S. bases in Okinawa, Japan, as she tells us about her book, Night in the American Village. And as Donald Trump continues to publicly bully Minnesota Representative Ilhan Omar with inaccurate tweets and mischaracterizations, what's the impact on Somali American women living in Minnesota, a place that has become a hub for Somali Americans?
We are contributing to the community through culture, through arts, you know, through work, through everything, but still people are so jarred by our appearance.
And finally, as our beloved friend Betty Reed Soskin, America's oldest park ranger and likely the world's oldest park ranger, celebrated her 98th birthday yesterday, the documentary outlining her life called No Time to Waste premieres tonight.
History is what happens to us every day, that we're all making history.
Betty's a rock star in the Park Service. Everybody will elbow their way through the crowd to get to say hi to Betty.
Thank you, Betty, for your extraordinary service.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. I'm Sharon Sabota. As we all know, especially those of us who listen to KPFA, stories are shaped, told, and remembered by who is at the table telling them. In this way, Rebecca Sonnenschein is a trailblazer in Hollywood, as she literally holds a seat at a table where many stories that we love are conceptualized. I spoke with Rebecca about how she's able to leverage her seat at a writing table to change the way that stories are told.
Hi, my name is Rebecca Sonnenschein. I'm a screenwriter. I work in television and film. My latest feature film is a film called The Keeping Hours, which is streaming on Netflix currently. I also have written for The Vampire Diaries, and I'm currently writing on a show called The Boys for Amazon.
And you do genre writing, and that's a field that's largely dominated by men. Can you talk about how you found your way into this arena as a woman and what it's been like for you?
Sure. When I first started, I did kind of intentionally go into genre writing because, one, I loved it, but two, there just weren't that many women working in the genre field, and it was kind of a misconception that women didn't care for genre or weren't good at writing genre, and so I guess I had something to prove. And I feel like adding a female perspective to genre, which is, you know, often horror films and action films and other genre material has tended to be very male from a male perspective, and women are sometimes portrayed in somewhat of a cookie cutter manner. They're the, you know, the bitchy girlfriend or the naive ingenue. And so I just feel like being able to add an authentic female perspective to horror or superheroes or any of those genres that have been dominated by men all these years, I think it makes it more appealing to everyone and more inclusive. And I don't know, deeper and richer and more like the world we live in, which makes every project better.
You mentioned that you used to go to the different events and you would be like the one female identified person and with mostly men. What is it that sparked your initial interest in genre projects and horror films to begin with?
Right. Well, I've always loved especially science fiction and especially supernatural projects. I think because I love world building in a way. I'm not so much in the horror genre, but in sci-fi genre or, you know, larger ghost stories. I love creating a world that doesn't exist or looking at a world that came out of someone's mind, basically. So, yes, I was always, I went to UCLA and they used to have these midnight screenings on Sunday night in Westwood. And they would screen kind of in rotation a lot. They would screen Terminator, Alien, Aliens, Terminator 2, Blade Runner, Altered States. They're movies with big ideas, action, and great characters, honestly. And I loved them, and it would be me and my best friend and then a bunch of dudes. But I've always like kind of run with the dudes. I was the only girl on the soccer team. I was the only girl on the kickball team. I've spent a lot of time being the only girl, and it's great that I'm not the only girl anymore.
That's great. And you've been speaking to screenwriting students and other writers and really giving them a lot of depressing news, such as in order to be a television writer, you need to absolutely live in Los Angeles, most likely, if you would like to be able to also pay your bills. You could do it for fun, but not in a way that's not going to require you to have a few extra jobs.
Yeah.
So a lot of people think if they win an award, if they win the nickel, that's it. But talk about what happened for you when you won the nickel, what happened with that script and kind of what your next steps were.
When I won the nickel, I got an agent and a manager, and then my agent dumped me, and then I left my manager, and my script got optioned, and then they let the option lapse.
And what was the script for? It looks nothing like what you're doing now.
Right. I wrote this very small character drama about a girl and her grandmother, which is like commercial gold, obviously. It got me lots of meetings, but I basically, yes, I won this big award and it did get my foot in the door, but then the door kind of slammed shut, but I still had my toenail in there. So I basically pushed it back open over a few years and got a different film made and got a new manager and a new agent.
And the different film was?
My first film was a film called Happily Even After, which is a romantic comedy, which I do not write anymore, but someone made it and it was super fun. And I was on set the whole time. We made it in San Francisco. It was just the best time with the nicest people. I think I've made zero money on it. I might've made a little bit of pocket change. But I think that every experience you have, there can't be an end goal always. You know, you have to enjoy the moments as they present themselves. And that, you know, it never got released. And it did screen at the Tribeca Film Festival, which was also very fun. But just the experience of making that movie, which probably wasn't very good because I wasn't a very good writer, was so much fun. I look back on it very fondly.
And you're extremely humble. I don't believe that it wasn't written well. Or I love how you're not, I love how the best writers are like, oh, I'm not a good writer. So that one actually the public was never able to.
I mean, it screened in quite a few festivals, actually. But I don't know whatever happened to it. No, actually. No, I don't know. I don't know where it went. I don't even think it's streaming. I don't think it's available. I don't know. I don't have a copy of it. I just remember it in my head. It was really fun.
What year is this? Just curious.
I think it was 2004, maybe? That seems right. That seems like when we screened at Tribeca.
This is like a broader question for women who are trying to break into this industry, or whether they're trying to write even a book or a manuscript or a screenplay or anything. The odds are sort of stacked against us, and there's a lot of obstacles, and you'll get a whole bunch of no's along the way as you are very successful and you've experienced this. What advice would you offer to other women who might be in the thick of it?
I think it's a good time for women right now, honestly. It's better than it's ever been. Not to say that it's perfect. Not to say that there's still not challenges, there are, but they are less so than they used to be. And I think that, you know, as women, we no longer have to, you don't have to swallow your tongue. You know what I mean? You don't have to go along to get along. It's okay to call people out on things that you find to be insulting or sexist. You don't have to laugh at jokes that you find inappropriate. And it's fine to just sort of stick up for yourself. That's our right as women. But most guys are actually really awesome. It's, you know, there's a few bad apples, but I don't really feel like I'm oppressed in any way. But I do think the advice is the same for everyone. You just have to keep at it. I fail so much. I fail all the time. I still fail all the time. You just have to be not afraid of failing because it's going to happen. So just accept that. Move on. You fall down, you pick yourself up, you keep going. There are so many disappointments in this business. You can't even imagine all the disappointments you're going to experience. But there's also a lot of great things about it. It's just a lot of sacrifice, and it's a lot of just putting one foot in front of the other, to be honest.
Great. And because you reminded me of this, we're also in the reemergence of the Me Too era, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which Tarana Burke had brought to life, and then Alyssa Milano brought back to life,
right,
or shed some extra light on it. So I guess the survival strategies you mentioned, like pushing back when people tell a joke or not laughing at certain things. But what's it like in the writer's room?
Yeah, sometimes I say, that's not funny. But you know, that also comes with age and experience. So I know that it's scary to have to do that when you're first starting out. No, I think that people are just more aware. I honestly think a lot of guys just didn't think about it ever. It just didn't cross their minds. And now they want to hear about it. They want you to tell them. They are open for business in terms of listening. So, or that's what I've found anyway. So yeah, it's just kind of trying to be honest instead of just not saying anything because you don't want to rock the boat. It's not really rocking the boat. It's just sort of saying, hey, I'd rather we not portray women in that way. Is there another way we can tell that story or another joke we can tell? That's what's changed over time.
Because now you have a seat at the table in the writing room, so you can actually influence what people are seeing.
Yeah, I think so. I try anyway.
How does it look in your writing room in terms of gender breakdown? Just curious.
It's mostly guys.
But you're there.
But I'm there, and I'm a loud mouth. So, it's me and another female, and then the rest are male. And that's just kind of the way it goes a lot of the time. But I'm also working on a super male-driven show right now, a very male show. So that makes sense to me. I think the important thing is just to keep the conversation alive.
You have a series that just started.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm working on a series called The Boys for Amazon. I'm a writer and an executive producer on that show. It's about superheroes. It's really a political satire. It's kind of a takedown of celebrity culture and the superhero genre. It's about ordinary people fighting back against corruption. And it's just, it's kind of a very provocative show, but it's got a lot of heart and a lot of emotional stakes. And I think we really care about the characters. We try to take very deep dives into all of our characters, which is what I love about writing.
And everybody has a different answer for this, even from one interview to the next. But on this particular day, and it's a broad question, but if you had to think about the most important lesson that you've learned on your journey so far, with all the various hats you're wearing, what would it be, and how'd you learn that, or who from?
I think what I've learned is there's always another idea. I think when we're first starting out, we think this is the idea and this is the one I've got and I've got to make this work and everything's riding on it. Sometimes you feel that way when you're trying to write television too. But there's always another idea. There's always more material out there. You shouldn't be worried about using it up or moving on from something that doesn't work. Or if you fail at something and you thought it was going to succeed, it's fine. You'll think of something else. You'll write something new. There's always more.
And if people want to follow you or keep an eye on what projects you're working on, do you have your own website? Or
I don't have a website. I do have a Twitter, whatever that's called, handle, I guess. I'm on Twitter.
Under your name?
Under my name, yeah. under my name.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much.
Sure, no problem.
You're listening to the Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 and online at kpfa.org. I'm Sharon Sabota, and I've been in conversation with Rebecca Sun and Shine about how she's able to leverage her seat as a writer in Hollywood to incorporate the voices of women. About half of the 54,000 U.S. military personnel in Japan are stationed in Okinawa. Okinawa is known by some as a utopia for its racial diversity and natural beauty. However, some women in the region, particularly those living in the towns bordering the military bases, have, in some cases, paid a price, as they may be more likely to experience sexual assault and less likely to report it. Akemi Johnson looked into these and other issues when she wrote the book Night in the American Village, profiling women in the region about their lived experiences.
I'm Akemi Johnson. I am the author of the book Night in the American Village, Women in the Shadow of the U.S. Military Bases in Okinawa.
And it looks like the book came out in June. Can you talk about really what the impetus of this book project was for you?
This project started many years ago when I was actually a college student, and I first visited the island of Okinawa and became intrigued by the place, especially the kind of multicultural borderlands around the many U.S. military bases there.
Talk more about that. Like, what was intriguing about that for you, and kind of what was drawing you in about the border area and the social landscape in Okinawa?
So it resonated with me personally because I am fourth generation Japanese American and biracial. And, you know, I had spent time on mainland Japan kind of thinking that I would feel a strong connection to the place. And I did, but I also felt very much a foreigner there, very much American. And in Okinawa, I found a place that felt like it had more space for someone like me. And I could kind of see some of my own experiences reflected in the landscape. There's really more of a mix of cultures. There's the American influence. There are, you know, a few dozen American military bases on this in Okinawa, and there's the Japanese influence, and there's the indigenous Okinawan influence as well.
If you had to give an elevator pitch for the story of your book, and I'm sure you don't want to give away the whole thing, and talk about why it's really relevant at this time, could you do that for us?
So I think a lot of Americans aren't aware that we have as many as 700 U.S. military bases abroad, and there are, you know, countless communities around these bases. And so my book is looking at what is it like to live around a U.S. military base abroad, and specifically looking at Okinawa, where we have a long history there. There's a new base being built, and asking the question, you know, do we need another U.S. military base on this island?
Can you give a snapshot of what is at stake for women in these towns that are bordering the bases?
I decided to focus on women's stories because I think that they are the ones arguably most affected by the U.S. military presence. They're the most likely to date and marry American service members, to work in the entertainment areas around the bases, and also be the targets of sexual assault. And so my book is a series of profiles of women who interact with the base presence in some way.
What was your process, and how did you get people to trust you enough to share their story?
I was lucky to have a Fulbright grant that allowed me to live in Okinawa for a year. So that was an incredible gift, and I could slowly build relationships that way and, you know, meet people through other people. So I got to spend time with many of these women and see their lives and also do in-depth interviews.
What surprised you the most?
I was surprised at people's ambivalent feelings toward the bases. Before I had gone to Okinawa, I had heard about the sexual assault and the anti-base protests that results from that. And I was expecting to face a lot of anti-American sentiment, anti-base sentiment, and that's there is a strong anti-base movement, but most people I met had much more ambivalent feelings about the base presence because many times they were connected to the bases in some ways. They had friends who worked on base. They maybe worked on base themselves. Their husband worked on base. They had friends in the military. They worked around the bases. And just they've grown up alongside these bases their whole lives, and they're part of the landscape. So for many people, it was more complicated.
Super interesting. Some years ago, I did a journalism project looking at the dynamics of interracial marriages of women who were marrying into Japan, and they were marrying, like, they were from places like the Philippines and maybe came in through the entertainment industry or China or Korea, mm-hmm. different places. Mm-hmm. And then there was this whole movement of Japanese housewives who really got together to empower them, to teach them the language, teach them how to navigate the system, really, and help them raise their children in Japan. And it, as I was reading some of the things about your book, and you mentioned it now, that there's more some intermarrying going on with Okinawan women marrying American men.
So I spend time with one group, this a support group for women who date American service members. So some women had got together and formed a group to reach out to other women who would have these common issues, you know, as you mentioned, like language barriers, cultural barriers. There's the, you know, the nature of the military where service members are coming and going. So there were definitely common challenges to these international relationships. And it was interesting because, you know, there was also this subgroup, a subculture really of women who say they only want to date American men. And there's a word for that, amejo, in Okinawa. And sometimes these women wouldn't speak English, but they still wanted to find a husband in the U.S. military. And they would, you know, go out on weekends looking to meet someone.
And so did they face an increased risk of, for example, getting into a marriage or a relationship where there's a power dynamic at hand or domestic violence situations?
I did meet one woman who was dealing with a domestic violence situation, and I'm not sure if her language ability, you know, was a factor in that. But I think one challenge for women who are not married to service members is that they can't go on base and access these services that are available to women, like counseling or help with legal issues. And so, you know, these fences really act as a barrier and prevent them from getting services they might need.
In the book, you explore a murder of an Okinawan woman by a serviceman in 2016. And I think this is something that's not on the radar of many Americans. Would you be able to talk a little bit about the case?
So I returned to Okinawa in early 2017, and at that time, people were still very much talking about this murder that had happened the year before in 2016 when a 20-year-old Okinawan woman named Rina Shimabukuro went out for a walk in the evening around her house, and she never came back, and eventually police questioned an American ex-Marine, and he confessed to seeing her walking, pulling over, and assaulting her, and he led police to her body in the woods. And when I was there, the story was just emerging, his confession, at least his version of the story, and it was very grisly. And so, you know, for many, this reignited anti-base sentiment and a call for, you know, removal of the bases from Okinawa. And also it was, you know, a reminder to many about the long history of sexual assault in Okinawa by U.S. service members.
Yeah, let's talk more about the sexual assault element and also anything else that you found out about this particular perpetrator. He admitted, so he was held accountable in Japan?
Yeah, he was found guilty of the murder in Japan, and he's now serving his life sentence, I believe. And until this murder, his story looked actually very common on the island. He was in the Marines, and when he left the military, he chose to stay in Okinawa. And there's actually a large presence of American veterans who live in Okinawa. Maybe they met a local woman, got married, have kids, and make Okinawa their home. He had even adopted his wife's last name, Shinzato, and said that he wanted to kind of, you know, disappear into Okinawa or make, you know, leave America behind him, and this was his new home. Not that his story is typical at all, but with the murder, but he was part of this community that I think we don't hear very often of American veterans who live in Okinawa. And they work on base. That's the other part, is that because of the base presence, they can get jobs as contractors on base where they can work in English and make a good living without having to learn Japanese and work in the Japanese environment.
From your vantage point, where's the military's responsibility in intervening
with the violence against women that is taking place around bases in places like Okinawa.
You know, people have been asking that question for many years, and there are multiple factors. And I think the military is aware of them and working to change them. But, you know, they have to do a lot better. You know, there's a strong drinking culture off base. There are a lot of bars and nightclubs, you know, outside any gate from the military base. And so, you know, service members go out and, you know, drink too much. And the military tries to curb that with curfews and bans on drinking, but it's obviously not working. And what I found is that there is also a dynamic going on in Japanese and Okinawan society where there's a very low reporting of sexual assault. Only about 4% of rapes are reported to police. And service members have admitted that knowing that fact helped lead them to commit sexual assault because they felt like they could get away with it.
They feel immune in some way. Is that what's happening? They're feeling like they're immune?
Mm-hmm. They feel like the odds are in their favor that it won't get reported. And in that murder that I mentioned in 2016, he admitted that. So something on the side of Okinawan and Japanese society needs to change as well, because women aren't feeling like they can come forward and report sexual assault. And so the problem is much bigger than most people realize, and it remains hidden.
You've talked about the underreporting. Other statistics about what the estimated actual numbers would be, even though they're not getting reported to the police?
I haven't heard an actual number. There's an activist that I profile in the book named Suzuyo Takazato, and she is working to document every instance of sexual assault that's occurred since World War II. And she's combing through, you know, oral histories and newspaper articles and police logs and all of these sources to try to come up with a number. But she says it's important not to focus actually on the total, because whatever that is never going to come close to the actual number.
Japan is one country where this is an issue, and there's hundreds of bases around the rest of the world. As somebody who's been collecting stories and lingering in this topic, what insight would you offer for us to think about as a culture in terms of a way to respond to this?
I think it isn't all bleak. You know, what I found and what was interesting is that the Okinawans I met, most of them did not see themselves as victims of the U.S. military presence. Instead, they were choosing to actively engage with the military presence in some way, even if that was, you know, fighting to remove it. But you know, the story is more complicated than, you know, these people are victims of the presence. But, you know, ultimately, I think my book arrives at the conclusion that there should be a base reduction in Okinawa, if not complete closure. And, you know, my goal really was to initially just raise awareness of these bases and have more Americans realize that we have this presence around the world and imagine what it's like for all these people around the world and start a conversation about, you know, is this something that we want?
For people who want to stand in solidarity and support Okinawan women, what can they do?
Well, there's a movement going on right now against a new base that's being built in Okinawa. It's on this gorgeous bay in the north of the island, home to all these endangered and endemic species. I've visited there. It's, you know, a gorgeous place. The plan is to fill in the bay with sand and gravel and build a new military base. And Okinawans have repeatedly demonstrated through democratic processes that they don't want this base. People are out there protesting it every day. And so I think if more Americans were aware of this too and supported their cause, that could help.
I was just reading about you and looking at some of the articles that you've written, and there's one piece, I think I found it on NPR, where you'd written about your identity, about growing up as an Asian American woman, and when you found the term Hapa during college, that it was an experience of relief and validation. And I wondered if you wanted to reflect on your identity and how that impacts your writing in general and maybe this project as well.
Well, I think being a mixed race person, I'm always looking for these gray spaces and ambiguity, and I don't like to see things in black and white, or I don't see things in black and white. And so I think that helped me arrive in Okinawa and try to get past this black and white rhetoric and look at more of the nuances and, you know, gray spaces. And I think that's how my identity affects my work.
And you mentioned that a big goal of writing this book was really to just raise awareness about the presence of BACEs and let people decide for themselves and think about, is this what we want to support, or do we want to support the movement to reduce the number of BACEs? Other important takeaways that you'd like readers to leave with after reading your book?
Well, I think one kind of universal message that has struck me in thinking about the book is that, you know, we see a place like this where there are these tall fences topped with barbed wire around these bases, and it's easy to see it as, you know, us versus them, two distinct places on either side of these fences. And in fact, the fences are much more porous than we might imagine, and we are all more mixed up than we imagine. So there's always more exchange taking place. And I think just remembering more of the humanity behind these political issues.
Speaking of the political issue aspect, are there any kind of action items or maybe demonstrations for this cause, anything timely on the horizon that we could let our listeners know about?
Well, it's really that the issue of that the new base that's being built, that's very much happening now and in the news a lot in Japan, but I don't think we see it much here in the United States, if at all. So, you know, that's a cause that people could get involved in right now, and it could make a difference right now.
Can you talk about what you understand about the new base?
So this is something that's been in the works since 1996, actually, in the aftermath of a brutal rape of a 12-year-old girl, a gang rape by three American servicemen. The U.S. and Japan agreed to close this one base that's in the middle of a densely packed city on the condition of building another base in a more remote area, but as I said, very ecologically valuable area. And many people argue that it's just not necessary on this small island that already has so many bases, and that this base could be many other places. It doesn't have to be here. But like I said, the U.S. and Japan have already moved forward in construction, so they've started dumping sand and gravel into the bay, but it's not too late, I think, to stop it.
When did they start construction, roughly? Do you know?
I think it was in the past couple years.
So if you had to think about what's the most important lesson you learned from your process of researching, interviewing, writing, and putting these stories together for this book, what would that be?
I think the most important lesson for me was to not assume anything about anyone. One woman I profiled, Daisy, is a Filipino woman who came to Okinawa to work in the bars and clubs around the bases. And I had heard that these women were trafficked and it was a terrible situation. And she just defied all my expectations and said that this was her choice. And, she emphasized her agency in the situation and that she made the best out of the situation and it was the right choice for her. And so I think throughout, I just realized, you know, you can't assume people's stories and you need to really talk to them and get to know them.
That's a powerful example. And how can people find you and learn more about your work and your forthcoming projects?
You can find me at my website, akemijohnson.com, or on Twitter at akemijohnson.
Thank you so much.
Earlier this month, Donald Trump retweeted a picture of Representative Ilhan Omar dancing, saying that she was celebrating the anniversary of the 9/11 terror attacks. Omar corrected Trump in her response tweet, pointing out that she was seen dancing on September 13th during the Congressional Black Caucus, which had no connection to the anniversary of the attacks. In her tweet, she also called out the president and called on Twitter to do something, saying, "The president of the United States is continuing to spread lies that put my life at risk. What is Twitter doing to combat this misinformation?" This summer, while I was in Minneapolis, a place that has become a hub for the Somali American community, I spoke with Jojo Abdi, an emerging fiction writer and a medical interpreter whose roots, like Ilhan Omar's, are in Somalia. Although she doesn't know Ilhan Omar personally, she says she is an inspiration to the Somali American community in Minnesota.
My name is Khadija Abdi. I also go by Jojo. I'm a medical interpreter and a writer.
And your roots are in Somalia. What is it that led you to Minnesota specifically?
Well, we moved to Michigan from Kenya in 2001, like 4 months before September 11 happened. And that has been my home We lived in the same zip code forever, but I came here for work opportunities. After I graduated college, I was working in finance because I have a bachelor in business administration, and the job was slowly suffocating my soul, so. And I couldn't find anything else, and I came here on impulse, really, and I found a community. I fell in love with the people here, both the Somalis and the Minnesotans.
And you're a fiction writer?
Yes. I write sort of speculative fiction with a bit of history. I'm curious about the in-between, yeah. The things that are spooky and interesting and scary to look at, but for me it's entertaining.
And you talked about a little bit over lunch about a piece that you're working on, or maybe a series of short stories about a traveling hijabi, you said. Would you like to talk a little bit about what that is or what inspired it?
So I'm writing a story about a time-traveling hijabi who's kind of pulled into the past of Somalia. And it comes from my curiosity of looking back into the history, a very difficult history of what went on there. And for me, it's a way to make sense of it through fiction. So it's really based on real events, but the way for me to visit there is to have that emotional distance from it is to write it through fiction and to use a character that no one would believe would exist in real life, but she's exploring real topics and real problems.
And it's not fair to ask you to do this in a sentence or two because the history is so complex, but could you give kind of a brief history for people who aren't aware at all about what's gone on in Somalia and has led so many people to this region?
So the history of Somalia, it's a long history. And so here's what most people don't know about Somalia. Somalia is the nation of poets. It's the nation of tribes. But we were colonized and we were divided into five different regions by the Europeans. And once we gained our independence, that caused a lot of tensions between the areas, and we ended up having a dictator for almost 30 years, I would say. And then that led into war, that led into instability, and because we have all these tribal problems, we could not really come back together. So we ended up being a fractured nation. But the Somali people, in essence, are very strong, very willful, and in essence, they're always building on whatever broken system they have. They manage to build on it, you know. They have really awesome telecommunication system that's, you know, even way ahead of the kind we have here. You know, we've been doing mobile money since the early 2000s. So there's a lot of, they're resilient people, in essence, is what I'm trying to say. You know, we carve a life in a very tough environment that's harsh and drought riddle, but it's also beautiful. And it's a story of struggle, but it's hopefully coming back to a story of coming together and rebuilding and recovering.
And you were telling me over lunch about what it is that has led this to be really a hub for people from that area. Could you talk about that?
So the first few families that came to America and then I think 1994, 95, right after the war, ended up settling here in Minneapolis. And they keep calling their family until there were enough people and more people joined in search for community. And so it became a hub for Somalis, even though it's very opposite of the kind of environment Somalis come from.
And what do you think is one of the ways that maybe Somali people in Minnesota or elsewhere might be misunderstood, or what do you wish that people knew about this group? And that's a very broad question, but maybe things from your experience.
I don't know that we are misunderstood. I feel we're very expressive as a community, but there are elements about our religion that's misunderstood, and it has something to do with the broader questions about what Islam is and post 9/11 in America. So a lot of that, whenever I see articles about it, it's a lot of questioning the strangeness, our appearance, and how, you know, questions about whether we are assimilating, even though we are assimilated, and we have doctors, we have nurses, we have janitors, we're working in every part of the economy, and we are contributing to the community through culture, through arts, you know, through work, through everything, but still people are so jarred by our appearance because we're trying to hang on to our cultural norms at the same time. So it's a story of, you know, being who you are and also joining this new broader America. So that's, I think, what people misunderstand. They think we're not assimilating when we are. I feel assimilated.
Or that there should even be an expectation of assimilation. That's a whole nother conversation, right? About like how can you maintain who you are and find your place?
Yeah. You know, at the end of it, America is it's a nation of immigrants and natives. And each of us, we bring something to what it means to be American. And it's what makes us beautiful and what differentiates us from the rest of the world. So
right now we have Representative Ilhan Omar in office, and she gets a lot of pushback and a lot of Islamophobic rhetoric is pushed her way. The president speaks harshly about her. I'm curious, what is it like to see somebody with similar roots to you in this position? And then what's it like to watch her navigating all of this very rocky political social terrain that she's on right now?
Well, she's certainly stronger than I am and braver than I am. And I worry about her and I worry for her. But I'm glad that she is asserting herself and, you know, showing that America is not just one way. It's not old white guy, and it's young people, it's people of color. So Ilhan Omar, I have much respect for her. And it makes me proud to know that she also grew up in the same refugee camp that I grew up in. And she came to America and she said, you know, I belong here. And she went on and, you know, she doesn't just work for the Somalis, and she's not just an ambassador for Islam, but she's an ambassador for Minnesota, and she represents all of us. So I'm very proud of her. It must be hard to stand for your convictions, to say what you feel, but the same thing is people always see her hijab before they see her. Even JFK, when he was getting elected, people were questioning whether he would be loyal to America or loyal to the Pope in the Vatican. So they would have to get over it. And Ilhan is handling herself very strongly, and I am proud of her, really.
So we'll end on that note. You said that people are seeing her hijab before her, and they're making their own narrative and some assumptions about that. What advice would you have to the broader community about helping people get beyond the hijab and realize it's just a piece of clothing that has a significance to people as individuals, but that they're still individuals? What words of wisdom could you give to people that might help open some hearts?
The one thing that cures, you know, feelings like that is to just interact with people who are different from you. At the end of the day, you're going to see everyone has the same concerns about their job, about their children, about their life, about their future and their passion. And none of this, what we wear on the outside and who we pray to and all that stuff, it just broadly makes us what's unique about this country. There's not just one religion that should be represented in, you know, our government. We should all come together, whatever background we come from. Make friends who are different than you. That cures ignorance and that cures misunderstandings. Ask questions, even difficult questions. We're open to it.
Any message that you would have for our president right now?
I don't think he would be listening to anyone who looks like me, so I don't know if I should. But for the people who work around him, hold him accountable. That's what I would say.
And finally, I end every interview with this question. If you had to think about your life journey so far, what would you say is the most important lesson that you've learned so far, and how did you learn it, or who did you learn it from?
I am learning to come and take up space and be at the table and not shrink back because people are different than me or might not understand me. And I stop justifying why I do things. So that's one of the things I'm learning about where I am in my journey, to be fully myself.
And why did you learn that it was important to take up space at the table?
I think mostly is I've always questioned whether I belong and why I should be here, or would people understand me, or what they would take from my message. And I just stopped caring, to be honest with you. I don't even try to define or explain in my fiction what I'm writing about. I'm like, there's Google for that. You know, if you have questions about what I'm talking about, or if I insert a Somali word or Arabic word or an Islamic word, there's Google for that.
And once you stopped caring, did it free up your writing and free up your art?
So much. It opened now I write what I want to write and what my characters are telling me, instead of trying to say, will it appear, would someone white or someone not Somali or someone not Muslim understand that? And you know what? They do understand it. They do. And when they have questions, they look it up or they're curious about it. So it freed me up to tell authentic stories about characters that I want to talk about.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 and online at kpfa.org. I'm Sharon Sabota. And finally, we want to give a shout out to Betty Reed Soskin, who turned 98 yesterday. She happens to be one of my all-time favorite interviewees and has become a good friend over the years. Betty is the oldest park ranger in the United States and, as I mentioned earlier, likely the oldest one in the world. She lives by the premise that there are multiple truths, all of which are valid and all of which need to be told. In 2018, her book, Sign My Name to Freedom, was published. And tonight, a special documentary called No Time to Waste is showing in the Mission Blue Chapel in Marin at 6 p.m. Here's a preview of the 50-minute documentary featuring Betty Reed Soskin.
If we don't know where we started, we have no conception of where we are or how we got here.
She is a national treasure, a walking history book.
History is what happens to us every day, that we're all making history.
Betty's a rock star in the Park Service. Everybody will elbow their way through the crowd to get to say hi to Betty.
Thank you, Betty, for your extraordinary service.
I'm not really a historian. I'm sharing my oral history.
She's sort of like Betty Davis, Angela Davis, and Yoda all wrote an interview.
She is the country's oldest full-time Park Service ranger, and she works in Richmond at the Rosie the Riveter World War II Homefront National Historical Park.
I didn't know about Rosie the Riveter's memorial because it had not freed anyone that I knew.
All the memorials, all the museums in the country are really about wars and the military. How do you look at the awkward parts of the story? It's not a pretty picture.
The history as I had lived it was nowhere in sight, not 1 minute of it.
She's able to talk about these incredibly difficult topics.
I was 27 years old, married, and a mother by the time my slave ancestor died.
And so now she has a platform and a willing co-conspirator in the National Park Service.
It's like I'm running a federally funded revolution.
The opportunity to insert the African American stories.
That's what the park became for me.
The young interpreters that are looking to Betty as a leader in learning about their own story.
Because what gets remembered is determined by who's in the room doing the remembering. So many people have lived my history, and so many people have lived your history. And the nation is bereft without those.
It took her the better part of her life to really find her own voice.
I have a deep sense of being in my last decade, that if I don't get it right, I don't have time to do it over.
This is a slice of history, that to not learn it is really not to know America.
My story is important because I represent an important part of the American narrative. And when I'm on this stool, my story will not be forgotten.
And that was a preview of the documentary of Betty Reed Soskin's life that's debuting this evening at Mission Blue Chapel at Cavallo Point. Tonight's screening is sold out, but don't worry, there will be plenty of screenings coming up in the weeks to come, including one at Mill Valley's Mind the Gap Film Festival on October 5th. Another screening will happen in Richmond on October 24th, in Sonoma on November 10th, and we're told that there'll be many other screenings. For more information and to just keep track of the events as they come, you can visit the events tab at www.rosietheriveter.org. As Betty Reed Soskin celebrates her 98th birthday this week, I want to recognize her because she's dedicated decades of her life to what we fight for here at KPFA, the right to share multiple truths. Because of this, we're going to leave today with a song that Betty wrote and sang many decades ago called Sign My Name to Freedom. As many of you might know, Betty is resting and recovering from some health challenges, so we want to send her out some healing energy along with happy birthday wishes. So happy birthday, Betty.
Monday morning, streets are bare. Seems as how they don't want me nowhere. Since I went to the courthouse and signed my name to freedom, daughter say, mustn't run. Sound of trumpets, the kingdom's come. Mama, go to the courthouse. Got to sign your name to freedom. Fields of fire.
But I finally decided that, in fact, I'm really everything. And it's a wonderful thing to be, after all. At least that's the way I see my beautifully blended grandchildren.
Betty Reed Soskin is, in so many ways, a Jane of all trades. She's the oldest national park ranger in the United States, and quite possibly the world. She works at the Rosie the Riveter Shipyard Museum in Richmond, California. Betty says she doesn't believe in retirement, that she stays young at heart by reinventing herself. This is perhaps why her life accomplishments are vast. She's an entrepreneur, a songwriter, a musician, a mother of four, a park ranger, a blogger, a lifetime activist, and now an author.
There's hope in the knowledge that many ordinary Americans are now beginning to see the fallacy in white supremacy and that its protection cannot be maintained without sacrificing democracy itself.
Betty Reed Soskin says she has lived into the future that she helped create.
Though I was an activist in the 60s, in the Civil Rights Revolution at the national level, I'm now living in the future that I helped to create. Those people protesting are now of every color, every ethnicity, every economic class. They're marching as Americans. It is an amazing thing to have lived through. I lived into a time when I have lost my sense of future because I've outlived most of my peers. Having done so, I've gained instead an enhancement of a sense of the past. Now I know that this democracy has been going through these periods of chaos since 1776. They're cyclical. That is when the democracy is being redefined. That is when the reset buttons are accessible to us. And rather than being depressed by what's going on in the country at the moment, I'm finding, to the contrary, that I am hopeful. Hopeful because all the things that characterize so much of my life, because I knew my slave ancestor, I knew her until I was 27 years old when she died, and she died at 102. I knew her, and all of the American history from the Dred Scott decision to Black Lives Matter is encapsulated in the voices of my great-grandmother, my mother, and myself, because we lived all of that history from 1846 to the present time.
I asked Betty how she continues to find hope in the face of immense racial tensions across the country.
Because having lived through the history that I've lived through, what I see, more than that chaos that we're seeing, that we're living in now, more than that, I'm seeing that the whole nation is seeing and sharing in the ugliness that's been known only to a portion of us. When the Tiki Torch Parade in Charlottesville happened, I was feeling elated because that was finally out in the open where it could be dealt with. I am so concerned when I hear people say, that's not who we are, because from my way of looking at it, that is precisely who we are. And as long as we're in denial, we can never get at that. part of us that needs to be corrected. And I think that that's what's happening to us. There is a place on the film that the National Park Service developed where a Rosie, who lives in Rossmore, and she says that period was the greatest coming together of the American people that she had ever lived through. And when the film was first released to us, I used to stand against the wall and watch the faces of the audience as she uttered those words, and I'd think, how can Agnes say that? She knows that isn't true. I've got to speak to that woman. And one day, after my 90th birthday, I was suddenly able to hear that that was Agnes's truth, and that there were many truths, that we all create our own reality, and that there are truths that rise out of religious conviction, and they rise out of education, they rise out of life experience, that many of those truths are in conflict, but nonetheless true. And I realized that as long as there was a place on the planet where Agnes's truth and mine could coexist, that that was going to be enough for me from that day forward. And for me, that's the park that I'm working in. And I get to share that insight with the 14-year-olds that come through, which I consider a real privilege. So they don't have to get to be 90 years old before they discover that. That probably is the most important lesson I've learned in the last decade.
The existence of multiple truths.
Yes.
Cotton flaming neath the summer sky. Shrouds of white, no name naming, dead or now, this dream can't die. Churches burn, deacon dead, still I know, it's like daughter said, ain't no turning back now. I done signed my name to freedom. Young folks here around my table talking through the night.
I'm Sharon Sabota. I've been your host and producer for today's show. To keep up with us, you can follow us online at kpfawomensmag.blogspot.com. You can also find us in the archives at kpfa.org. It's been a pleasure spending the hour with you, and I hope you all have a beautiful afternoon.
Bombed it Wednesday, but I can't care. God was down at the courthouse. Day I signed my name to freedom. My Lord was down at the courthouse. Day I signed my name.